I've wanted to talk about meditation on this podcast for some time, and I've managed to track down a real expert in the field to cover this subject. Dr. Dawson Church has written a highly influential book called Bliss Brain, in which he's done lots of research, scientific and also spiritual, and he talks about how we can find techniques to help us when intrusive thoughts come in and interrupt the focus of our meditation, which I know happens to me quite a bit. He also covers what happens in the brain when meditating. So we had a very enlightening and quite deep conversation about all the aspects of meditation. So whether you're thinking of taking up meditation or are a regular meditator already, there's something here for you in this podcast. So I highly recommend listening all the way through to the end. He's got lots of pearls of wisdom, which is well worth on picking up. So here we go. Here's a long conversation all about meditation with Dr. Dawson Church.
I'd like to really dig into a nutty subject with you about meditation, which has been on my mind for some time, and I'm sure is very much on your mind in the books you've written about meditation, particularly your wonderful book, Bliss Brain. So it's a big question, really. Is meditation, in your opinion, a spiritual practice or just a mind training technique?
I think it's both, because it's definitely a spiritual practice as you let go of what I call in my books local mind. And most of the time, most of our days, we're in local minds. So I went to my cupboard this morning, picked out a certain color shirt, and I made plans for the day and made sure that all these things were happening before our interview today. And so that's all to do with my local self, local mind. But then there's also research on non-local mind. And when we let go of our obsession with our local reality and then move into communion with non-local reality, and especially if we do it in a powerfully emotional way, there's a whole field of science called relational spirituality. And relational spirituality literally is able to trigger gene expression, reshape internal biochemistry, neurochemistry. It's able to shift many things inside the body. So we are moving into this experience of something greater than ourselves and letting go of our obsession with something that is mundane and ordinary and usual and local in our lives. And that is powerful. So it's both that sense of something larger than yourself, a spiritual experience. It's also shaping both the mind and the brain. But the mind is first. The mind is what makes the decision that I will set my alarm clock, or I will wake up early, or I will do whatever it takes to meditate. So there's an element there of mind training that then moves into brain training. And then that opens the door, at least opens the door, to higher spiritual experiences and that oneness with non-local self.
Thank you. That's a great explanation. As somebody who meditates but also has interruptions, perhaps intrusive thoughts that kind of cloud sometimes my meditation, this is really the kind of heart of the matter in your book for me. But can we just chew on that a little bit about why these thoughts come in when you're meditating? You're trying to clear your mind or quieten your mind, but nonetheless, you get interruptions. What's that all about?
About 60% of the brain's mass, so our brain weighs roughly a kilogram or 2 pounds. It consumes 20% of our body's oxygen and other biological resources. So it's a really highly active piece of tissue. And about 60% of its mass is to do with vision and is to do with processing vision, because unlike our dog or a rat, which has a big part of its brain devoted to its olfactory system and scent, we are focused primarily visually in terms of our evolutionary development and the structure of our brains. And there are about 9 million pieces of information per second passing through the optic nerves into the occipital cortex in the back of the head. So we got all this information flooding in, and it's in terms of evolutionary survival, it's been incredibly adaptive. We have this ability to scan the horizon, notice threats, react very, very quickly. And that's what kept our species alive for thousands of years, tens of thousands of years, and allowed us to survive. So when we close off that source of information, we shut our eyes, then suddenly those 9 million pieces of information per second aren't hitting the occipital lobe and that 60% of the brain that is engaged by vision. And so what does the brain do? It has all the spare capacity. It's like you've shut down 60% of a motor, and now it's just idling with nothing to do. And so what it does, it doesn't stop consuming less oxygen, less resources. It keeps on going. And what it does is it finds things to focus on that aren't visual. And that's usually the past and the future. And again, that's a highly adaptive evolutionary innovation that we want to focus on things that may have hurt us in the past, things that might hurt us in the future. So our brain defaults to functioning in two core areas. One is the mid prefrontal cortex, right in the front of the brain. It's pretty much right behind your eyebrows, going back an inch or two. And then the back of your brain, the posterior cingulate cortex. These two brain regions form the default mode network, and they process information like threats from the past and potential problems in the future. But where they are not is in the present. And so that's why when people close their eyes to meditate, they're flooded with regrets and worries and depression about the things that didn't work out for them in the past, and anxiety about what might not work out for them in the future. And so the default mode network clicks in whenever our brains aren't engaged in a task. And it's the seat of the suffering self. People who are depressed have a highly active default mode network. Tibetan monks, Franciscan nuns, other groups that we study in neuroscience, they have an extraordinarily inactive default mode network. They aren't thinking about self. They aren't self-focused. They are not wondering which saffron robe to wear today, or whether I need to pick up the dirty one from the dry cleaners. They just aren't thinking about all this stuff. They're that part of the brain shutting down. They're moving into the sense of oneness with the all that is. Totally different parts of the brain light up. The attention network lights up. The part of the brain that suppresses activity of the default mode network lights up. The emotion regulation circuit, very, very clear circuit that links the front part of the brain with the emotional parts of the brain and allows us to shut off emotionality, that part becomes highly active. And the fourth of the four circuits I talk about in this brain that lights up is the compassion circuit. So what we see in these monks and nuns is that the obsession with self just goes away. That part of the brain has a precipitous drop in activity. These other four circuits, which we call collectively the enlightenment network, light up. And then you aren't all obsessed with the stuff from the past and the future. You come into the present. And that's why these meditators describe being in this eternal present, the drifting in bliss. We see amplitudes, amounts of brainwaves like gamma, the highest frequency brainwave, 30 cycles per second and up to hundreds of cycles per second. Huge amounts of gamma show up in the brains of these monks and nuns. So they're shutting down the suffering self when they meditate, and they're moving into this oneness with the universe. They are unbelievably happy because gamma is the wave of compassion, joy, awe, gratitude, extreme bliss. And these people are absolutely stoned. They're literally, the amount of anandamide, the bliss molecule in their brains is enormous. The amount of oxytocin, serotonin, dopamine, they are high on all these exquisite neurochemicals, and they're in this altered state. So when we close our eyes, for most people, it's the default mode network that lights up. For experienced meditators who meditated effectively for a long time, they close their eyes and they just soar into ecstasy, and then they stay there for as long as that happens. After a while, with training, you train yourself to be able to open your eyes and remain in that awake state. So for novice meditators, it's harder, but with practice, you're basically meditating with your eyes wide open all day long.
sounds wonderful. But I'm thinking, how can ordinary people who are not Tibetan monks or have a deep spiritual practice. how can they work on achieving that? Now, I'm not saying there are shortcuts to enlightenment by any means, but how can they come into meditation and be happy in that state? So really, are they able to rewire their survival instincts?
Oh, you mean, so you don't want to go into a convent or a monastery and take vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, spend 10,000 hours in meditation, which takes, that's like 10 years full time. So it is another path. So if we were doing this interview, say in 2000 BC or even 1000 AD, the answer would have been, that's the way you do it, because that's the way we'd figure out how to do it. You enter the convent or the monastery, or you went into the Himalayas and found a cave, and you spent 10,000 hours, and maybe you began to get somewhere in 10,000 hours with enough guidance. And that was the best we had. And then along came Hans Berger in 1920 and invented the electroencephalograph. And so suddenly we had this thing that could actually read your brain waves. Now, he was mocked and ridiculed. In fact, he eventually committed suicide, the guy who developed the EEG. He was so discouraged by the negativity around his research. But later researchers in the 1960s, like Robert Becker and Max Cade, took this EEG, hooked it up to the brains of these adepts who'd done the 10,000 hours, and they began to notice something. And that something was that whether those adepts were Kabbalists or Qigong masters or Buddhists or Hindus or Protestant or Catholic people who had entered really, really deep mystical states, their brainwaves, when they were in ordinary consciousness in local mind, looked wildly different. When they entered that state, their brainwaves all look the same. They take this characteristic pattern of all the main brainwaves, from delta, the slowest one, to gamma, the highest one, which we call the awakened mind. And so they discovered that these people are in an awakened mind. And that has been an absolute game changer. Later on in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, we developed things like SPECT scans, CAT scans, and eventually MRIs, and eventually functional MRIs. And then we could look at the brain, the blood flow in the brain, which regions were active, and also which regions were growing and shrinking. And that, again, has produced a huge leap of understanding. So what we've now done is we have total respect for the people who stumbled around for 10,000 hours like I did in my 20s and 30s and 40s. And those paths, long path, is really a powerful way to moving into awakening. But we've now taken all these brain scans and we've just said to people, okay, do this. And then we look at the scan and say, oh, is that producing awakened mind? It really isn't. Let's try this. Is this producing awakened mind? Go read your scriptures. Let's see what happens. And they read their scriptures and nothing much happens. They sit in the lotus posture. Nothing happens. They put on a saffron robe. They shave their head. Nothing happens. They feel compassion and the needle goes off the charts. So we now have used neuroscience to identify what is effective. And we literally, I'll give you a really just absolutely remarkable example. So I did a randomized controlled trial. This is a huge, ambitious, expensive study that has just been published in one of the top neuroscience journals in the world. And it was a randomized controlled trial where we used really state-of-the-art, high-resolution fMRI machines, and we measured people before and after 1 month of using a meditation technique I developed called eco-meditation. And so the experimental group did eco-meditation 22 minutes a day for 1 month. The control group did mindful breathing for 1 month. Then they went back in the MRIs and we measured their resting brain state. And we found that that suffering self part of the brain, the default mode network, had just dialed down. And it hadn't just dialed down in meditation, it had dialed down in real life. And the compassion part of the brain had lit up like a Christmas tree. So people were able to enter these advanced states, but now they're doing it not just hit and miss, trying to, you know, count their prayer beads or their rosary. They're doing stuff that science says, this really works. They're feeling compassion and they're breathing a certain way and they're relaxing certain muscles, which increases the activity of the vagus nerve. And so they're doing all of these things that we know from research really work. And I showed those scans to one neuroscientist. He didn't know where the scans came from. These were the composite scans of the group that did eco meditation. He looked at the scans. He said, "Oh, you know, we see these all the time. These are clearly the scans of Tibetan monks with 10,000 hours." And I said, "Actually, those are the scans of ordinary people, non-meditators, after 28 days and doing it 22 minutes a day. So we're showing that they're getting into awakened mind and it's changing their brain structure in less than a month. And that's what's different about now is we have the evidence to separate the wheat from the chaff. And I don't, again, mean any disrespect to all the masters I studied with or all the lung path stuff, because I mean, I spent 50 years doing this before I figured it out. But now it does not take 50 years, does not take 10,000 hours. We literally start people off, and in 28 days, their brains change. In 6 months or more, they change a lot.
So I'm hooked. And I have read your book, or most of it. And so I do have an understanding of your seven techniques. But given the short time we have available, could you briefly explain those techniques in ordinary terms so that people listening who may be either struggling with meditation or maybe haven't really taken it up or maybe are not able to do it regularly enough, how have these seven techniques helped this, you know, situation of meditating?
Well, a big insight I had, I learned EFT tapping, emotional freedom techniques tapping, around 2000-2001. And I also then did some research and discovered that it rapidly remediates PTSD. So between like 2000 and 2015, we published many randomized controlled trials, meta-analyses showing that EFT helps with PTSD. And what I was so intrigued by about that was that it helps it not by working with the mind, but by working with the body. It's just tapping on acupuncture meridian points. And so you tap on these points and people's fight or flight response just goes away, even when they have been terribly traumatized as children. So I saw how a physical intervention was able to affect psychological, behavioral, and biological change. And that was a real insight for me. And I'd struggled with meditation. I've been doing meditation since I was 15 years old and went to live on a spiritual community. And I never was able to master monkey mind. I was never able to stop my thoughts. In fact, I meditated this morning. I got up, you know, several hours ago and spent 2 hours meditating. And if I had a 10-minute stretch of no monkey mind, that would be a big deal. And that's after 50 years of learning meditation. So even experienced meditators will have their minds will cycle back to random thoughts. But what I realized was if we combine physical cues to the body, we can do things that we can't do with mind training. And so with my eco meditation method, I simply had this insight one day. I was at a conference, actually, and there were all these presenters, keynote speakers, and we were sharing in our speaker's lounge behind the stage about how great heart math is and how great mindfulness is and how good neurofeedback is for calming people down and how wonderful EFT is for removing the stress response. And I thought, you know, what if we just stacked them all on top of each other and did them all in sequence? So I began to try it on myself. I do some tapping, do some mindfulness, do some vagal nerve regulation, all physical stuff, breathing rhythms, relaxing certain muscles. And I found I could drop into a deep state really quickly, all of a sudden doing it that way. So I asked the conference organizer, "Can I do this with the whole group?" She said, "Yes." And so I literally, the first time I did it with a group, watched 200 people not only drop into heart coherence, but drop into collective coherence. The whole group did it together. And so I realized that it was physical interventions like that that were able to get people into these deep states. They enter into a really deep meditative place, but their minds are alert. They're alert, but their bodies are relaxed. And so it's purely physical interactions. They're doing a little bit of heart math, a little bit of neurofeedback, a little bit of self-hypnosis, a little bit of EFT tapping, and the combination of stacking all those methods together, they're all evidence-based, that rapidly physiologically produces the ideal state without you having to still your mind.
Is it difficult to learn tapping techniques and then bring them into meditation?
Simon, if you just tap on the side of your hand to start with, just below where your the bone that anchors your little finger, that's one point we use in EFT. Then if you tap on the top of your head, that's another point. That's called the meeting of 1,000 paths in acupuncture. There's so many meridians that flow through there. Then you tap where your eyebrow meets the bridge of your nose, and then you tap on the side of your eye, and then you tap under the pupil of your eye, then under your nose, then under your lower lip, then where your collarbone meets your breastbone. You've just done it, and it took about 20 seconds. So it's not hard to learn. It doesn't take long.
And what's it like to actually do that when you're meditating? Or is that what you do before you meditate?
I did before I meditate, because the percussion and the movement would be distracting during meditation. I may do it afterwards, or I may do it if I have too many thoughts. There are little techniques you can use like that. Say, for example, if I have a very busy work day ahead and I start thinking about that, I'll do some tapping to release my mental focus on that.
Is there an optimal time in the day to meditate?
Absolutely. Definitely first thing in the morning. And I have one of the most popular courses on the big education platform, Mind Valley. I have meditations on Insight Timer. Eco-meditation is all over the web. There's hundreds of sites that have it besides my site, because we've made it freely available from its inception. And so there are all kinds of places you can get eco-meditation. And in all of these places, I say, do it first thing in the morning, because when we fall asleep, our brains drop out of high activity mode. And that's beta. Our brain waves are in beta for most of the day. And that's just the conscious mind. If we're a little anxious, we have a lot more beta. But then when you are either finishing a task or taking a little bit of a break, your brain slows down a bit and goes into alpha. And so neurofeedback training is going to train you to enter that alpha state. When you're in alpha, usually you have better heart rate variability, and a lot of other things improve as well. But when you go to sleep, you drop into the two slowest brain waves, theta and delta. And then when you start to wake up, you go back into alpha, and then eventually snap into beta, and your conscious everyday day begins. And so what you want to do is, when you're sleeping and you're in theta and delta, you're in these slow brain waves. They're also the brain waves of hypnosis. They're the brain waves of trance. They're the brain waves of flow. They're the brain waves of highly creative people. And they're the brain waves of sleep and dreaming. And so you've been in these brain waves of sleep and dreaming for 6, 7, 8 hours. You then, when you wake up, you can start to move back into alpha. If you don't intervene, you go back into beta, and then your mind is totally wired. You want to, while you're still in that dreamy, half-awake state, meditate then, because you can drop back then into theta and delta, and then it really enhances neural plasticity, because theta is the brainwave of wiring. It's when your brain is wiring new connections in your learning centers. Delta is the brainwave of deep sleep, when you're pruning and your brain is pruning away old connections you no longer use. So you want to be in that state, so you're doing as much wiring around positivity and as much pruning of negative thoughts as you possibly can.
So are you advocating we all stay in bed and meditate?
Yeah, you know, I looked when I was writing BlissBrain, one of the things I had fun with is I looked at, because, you know, I wrote BlissBrain at a time when I just lost everything in my life. I tell the story in the first part of the book. I won't tell it now, but I'd had a devastating series of losses. And I was amazed that in the year after that, I should have been traumatized and felt terrible, and I felt wonderful. So, but one of the things I did when I was writing the book is I looked for celebrities who meditate. And a lot of people who are high performers, like Tim Ferriss in his book Tribe of Mentors, says that virtually every high-performing person he meets meditates. Dave Asprey says that people he knows that are doing well meditate. Tony Robbins says the same thing. Joe Dispenza says that meditation is really crucial. But like Taylor Swift, the singer, she is the number one female singer in the world, and she wakes up, she meditates immediately. She wakes up, doesn't wait half an hour, doesn't go and take a shower and have breakfast. He just wakes up and immediately meditates. So you find many power meditators, many of these top meditators, top creatives especially, are meditating right when they wake up.
That's really interesting, actually, because I think I believe that you needed to get up and kind of start your day in a certain way. And yes, try and meditate perhaps during your time of whatever your personal daily practice is. But it is rather nice to meditate when you're tucked up in your bed. So yeah, that's really interesting.
But do sit up, because when you sit up, different things happen in your body. So you sit up and meditate in bed is fine, but just in an upright position.
Yeah, because I've heard lots of things about your body position, that you must have a straight back. And one thing, which I think is a Buddhist technique, is to have your knees on the ground. And I'm not quite sure how you achieve that very easily, unless you can do the lotus position and hold it for quite some time. So do you see that or say that your physical position is not all that important when you're meditating?
The masters usually do emphasize the desirability of a straight spine. And I know even now I'm sitting here and as we're sharing right now, I'm sitting on like an curved exercise ball type surface, and my spine is straight up and down. I know I'm just more creative that way. So I don't know that there's any research behind this. Everything else I do is evidence-based, but I just take it from the masters that a straight spine is desirable. I know certainly that if you are reclining, certainly if you're lying down, that's the same position as sleep. So you suggest your body that it's time to sleep when you're lying down. That's why sitting up is really a signal to your body to be alert, and sitting straight up, I find, really promotes that sense of connection with something larger than yourself.
And the connection to something larger than yourself is really, for me, the kind of reward for practicing and for sticking with it. But I'm not sure that all that many people reach that state. Do you need to meditate for, 20 minutes minimum, maybe half an hour optimal or longer, to reach that state, that blissful state?
Well, one of the questions I asked in Bliss Brain was that very question, because I'm a researcher, I want to know what science says. And I came at all these questions with a totally open mind when I wrote the book. I just looked at the neuroscience, and then I reported in the neuroscience in the book. One of the things that does is it dispels a lot of myths. There are tons of like, I heard so many instructions about how to meditate, and Simon, about 95% of them were just misleading or useless. Over the course of the classes I've taken and the books I've read, there are only a few things that really count. And so you want to do things that are going to be effective, and then discard the ones that aren't. So what science says is that a brief meditation will produce an effect. The shortest studies that have been done are of 12-minute meditations. So 12 minutes we know a day is able to shift gene expression, shift neurobiology, produce marked changes in the body and in the brain. So 12 minutes is sort of the minimum dose that we find of an effective meditation. Again, an ineffective meditation you can do for an hour. Like I was wondering how to explain ineffective meditation to people in the book, and one man who worked for me came into the office that day. This is pre-pandemic. I was grappling with how to explain ineffective meditation. And I knew his girlfriend, who we lived with, was a meditator. And I knew also that every day he woke up early to go to work, she was meditating. He would tiptoe around the apartment, make sure he didn't make a noise. And she was sitting there in the lotus position, looking very Buddha-like and very calm. But that morning, he looked shaken when he walked into the office, and he said, "Oh yeah, today I was tiptoeing around and I just made a little bit of a sound." And when she heard the sound, she came out of meditation and she screamed at me. She said, don't fuck with my serenity. So there are people who spend an hour, like this woman. Obviously, she was nowhere near an elevated state. And so, again, that's why I say you need an effective meditation method. So, again, 12 minutes is the minimum in studies. 20 minutes, most of my eco meditation tracks are about 20 minutes long. People report they can get in to the deep state in that length of time. But you definitely feel so good, people get motivated to spend longer, 30, 40 minutes. One of my most frequently asked questions when I'm on webinars is, Dawson, there are all these 15, 20-minute tracks all over the web of you doing eco-meditation. Please, can I have a 45-minute one? People are actually craving longer tracks because what are they craving? They're craving anandamide, they're craving serotonin, they're craving dopamine, they're craving all of these neurochemicals that meditation unlocks in your brain. They're so highly pleasurable when someone says after 22 minutes, oh, time's up, got to come back down to earth. People are like, no! I want to stay there.
Is it a good practice to, you know, and I'm thinking about people who are listening who might be beginners or intrigued about meditation and they're listening to this podcast. If they start at 12 minutes and do that for a period of time, is it a good idea to then extend to 15 minutes, do that for a period of time, and then 20, and then go up from there? Is it a good idea to be progressive?
Any meditation is better than no meditation. And just doing it, it's like going to the gym, you know, some days you feel like it, some days you don't. Forget about whether you feel like it or not. Just do it. You know, make a commitment to yourself to do it. I mean, if you read the health benefits of meditation alone, if you believe nothing about a higher power, about non-duality, about your spiritual life or practice or growth, just do it for your health. And so just make a commitment, just like you go to the gym, just like, you know, you don't eat crap, you don't drink dirty water, you don't abuse your beautiful physical body, you want to take care of it. And so just for that reason alone, it's worth doing a little bit every day. You will build up. People doing eco-meditation tend to then want to move into the kind of 40-minute range after they've done the 15, 20-minute range. And then after a while, it starts. Now, again, this is after a while. This isn't in the first 2 weeks. But it starts to get hard to come back again. And so for people like me, the challenge isn't going out there. The challenge is getting back. So every single eco-meditation track, and if you're using another track that doesn't include this, do it anyway. But every single one of my tracks includes a grounding exercise at the end. You feel yourself coming back into the body, because if you don't, I've literally had accidents where I forgot to ground myself, walked out into the world, and you know, you're just out there. You need to get back in here in your body. And we want to, you know, 1,000 years ago, back in the monastery, it was fine to be floating 20 feet above your body as a disembodied soul all day. Right now, with traffic, with schedules, with children, with partners, with money, with the modern life, you have to embody it. And so the arc, like we have a class called The Short Path to Oneness, and it trains people over 9 months to enter these awakened states. It's a real commitment. It's half an hour a day for 9 months, and you have a mentor, you have a therapist, you have a lot of support doing this. But for that 9 months, you're doing this, and then you're grounding yourself every day. And the last part of the course is all about embodied awakening. It's not being that monastic. I mean, that was the model 1,000 years ago. Today, we need people who then come back and take action on climate change. We're going to take action on racism. We're going to take action on social problems. We're going to be great parents, great team members, great husbands, great wives, great partners. We need people who are activists in the world, and we have a world that needs people right here who are embodying their spirituality. So on our 9-month Short Path to Oneness course, you definitely end it in the last few months with an embodied spirituality. You're grounding yourself after every meditation, and you're moving your practice into everyday life. Eventually, you're doing it eyes open, so you're meditating all the time, and then you're active in the world in your daily work as well. You're doing charitable work, you're donating, you're volunteering, you're making a difference in the outer world, because the outer world needs enlightened, embodied, awakened people taking concrete action to make changes.
I just want to pick up on one thing before we finish, and that's that you can meditate with your eyes open and go about your kind of business if you got really that good at it. You know, I didn't know that was possible.
No, actually, it's the goal of meditation. Closed eyes is just a stage you practice in. Closed eyes is practice meditation. The goal of the masters was to learn to meditate eyes open. Like I had a friend who asked, he was in India, and he asked one of the gurus there, he said, he just asking him a lot of these same questions. He said to him, how many times a day do you meditate? How often do you meditate? And the guru said, once a day. And my friend said, and what time of day is that? And the guru said, all day, because he has eyes open. And so if you go for neurofeedback training, you'll find that they do EOEC. And some of my research will see EOEC. EC, eyes closed, is the easy bit. It's easy to learn and practice with eyes closed. But after a while, it's EO, and we measure the awakened mind, EO. And we find the awakened mind is there in any EO, not just in spiritual masters. We find the mind, the awakened mind pattern is in their brains, EO, eyes open, in musicians in flow, in research scientists who are making a breakthrough, in business people who are highly creative, in artists, in writers, in sports people who were in flow. One Olympic athlete described being like watching herself from above the stadium as she ran the relay race she was running, and she wound up winning. Her team wound up winning, but she was in this state of eyes open flow. So flow is the eyes open state of the awakened mind, and people are extraordinarily effective when they're in that state. We've just done a study. We published in a peer-reviewed journal in about a year, but it shows that people who are entering these elevated states, they're definitely transcending, they're one with you all it is, they come back then and they bring their flow into their daily lives, they become 20% more productive at their daily lives. They are now achieving in 4 days what used to take them five. So they're becoming extraordinarily productive, and it's making a real difference in their daily life.
Well, that really does sound like an answer for humanity to deal with its immediate problems, which you alluded to earlier in the podcast. So just before we close, where can people experience eco-meditation? How can they get hold of this alchemy that you've come up with?
Yeah, well, it's always been free. It's free still. It's just eco-meditation.com. And just go there, you download the basic 22-minute track and just use it. And then if you want to, there's one track which we found. So one of the studies of eco-meditation, there's a lot of research on it. We found that it boosted immunity dramatically. So your immune system, these little molecules called immunoglobulins, which protect your body from viruses, rose 37% after a weekend of eco-meditation. So there's a special track to do with immunity. And that track is at a different link, which is tapping, just like EFT tapping, tappinggift.com. So that's where you can get the immunity version of eco-meditation. But for the regular version, just go to eco-meditation.com. It also puts you into the ecosystem of practitioners and books and programs, and all of those other resources are also available through that one eco-meditation.com link.
Wonderful. Dawson, thank you very much for your time this morning where you are, this evening where I am. It's been enlightening and enthralling talking to you, and many thanks and good luck with all that you're doing. Thank you.
It's just a delight to be in a place where you're entering that oneness every day, Simon, and then coming back and having an absolute blast with everyday life. So thanks for having me.
As Dawson said there in the podcast, his eco meditation is available free from ecomeditation.com, or the immunity version is available at tappinggift.com. But I'll put those in the show notes with links that you can also use to get hold of those meditations. I do hope you enjoyed this podcast, and thank you very much for listening.